The Laura Murphy Show, episode 69.
Welcome to The Laura Murphy Show, the podcast that analyzes financial markets from the perspective of Austrian economics and Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept. Listen and learn as your hosts, Robert Murphy and Carlos Lara, explain how you can be part of building the 10%.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of The Laura Murphy Show. I am one half of your hosts, Bob Murphy. With me, as usual, is Carlos Lara, hailing from Nashville, Tennessee. How's it going, Carlos?
Bob, I'm doing really good.
You know, Nashville's a fun place. I really ought to get up there. Is there any reason I should get up there?
It is. Downtown Nashville is, it's like Las Vegas now. It's like New Orleans. I mean, it is a very exciting place to be in. There's a lot of tourists that come into Nashville now almost every day. So Nashville has turned into a very exciting city. Yes.
So, like, you know, I don't know, if I were to go up there in May, probably the weather's pretty good.
May is a perfect time to come to Nashville. You're right.
Yeah, folks, we're being coy here, obviously, because what we're doing now, this is part two of three of our business owner, IBC for the Business Owner series, and we're just being joking around because, of course, in conjunction with us doing this three-part series on the podcast, we have a seminar for the business owner that's going to be held in Nashville, Tennessee on May 10th, 2019. So the details for that, and remember, there's only 25 slots. So if you're a business owner and you want to get in, then do it now. Don't dawdle. Go to laramurphy.com/bizowner. So B-I-Z owner, all one phrase. That's lara-murphy.com/bizowner. And you can get all the details for that May 10th seminar that we're putting on just for business owners. So what we're doing now here, again, this is part two of three in this series. Again, I'm providing some more economic analysis from an Austrian point of view, of course, to help guide the business owner in terms of where are we in the state of the economy. And Carlos is going to be giving more specific information to help guide the business owner as to how do I use IBC-designed policies to manage my cash flow. So I thought the topic I would tackle today has to do with the yield curve inversion. So if you're a longtime listener, and particularly if you're a subscriber to the Laura Murphy Report, so remember, folks, every month we release the Laura Murphy Report, and that's a subscription publication. There, I go into much more detail about this, but for our purposes here, the yield curve has recently inverted, and that's got a lot of people, you know, concerned is a recession coming. So what's going on there is the basic story, and then I'll give sort of the Austrian take on it. So the basic story is the yield curve, meaning if you plot maturities on the x-axis, right? So the closer to the axis is the 0 point, you know, 1 month, 3 month, 6 month, going out up to 30 years, let's say. And then on the y-axis is showing the yield. Normally, that's upward sloping, right? So that the longer you have your money invested, if you buy a 30-year treasury, you're going to get a higher annualized rate of return or higher yield on that than if you have just a one-month or a two-month, that sort of thing. And so what happens when the yield curve so-called inverts, it means the yield on those shorter maturities is higher than on the longer ones. And so the reason that's considered an important thing to watch, an indicator, is that historically, at least since World War II, if you properly design your metric, then it is a correct statement to say that every time a recession has occurred, there has been a preceding yield curve inversion, and then vice versa, every time there's been a yield curve inversion, there has been a recession. Okay, so in terms of using this thing as a forecast tool, there are no false positives and no false negatives. Okay, now the caveat there is you got to design it properly, right? So it's not just if there's a one-off invert, you know, like one afternoon for 14 minutes, one type of treasury maturity that was of a shorter yield had a higher yield than a shorter maturity had a higher yield than one of a longer maturity, and then it went back to quote normal. That doesn't count. When we say every recession has been preceded by a yield curve. They pick the measurements in a certain way. So it's a certain type of average, like 3 month versus 10 year. And it's got to be like a monthly average. Okay. So I'm not getting into all those nuances here because, you know, you're driving on the road. You're not going to remember it anyway. I'm just saying, don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying any one-off inversion of any type of shorter versus longer maturity has always gone hand in hand with the recession. I'm saying, though, that when it persists and it's particular types of maturity disparities, that's the thing that, yep, every time that's happened, at least since World War II, there's eventually been a recession. And I don't mean eventually like 20 years later. I mean, you know, one that was within 18 months, let's say. Okay, so that's the basic fact. And so as we're recording this, you know, it was right when we were recording actually part one that the thing happened, that the yield curve happened, the inversion happened. And so, you know, this is our first chance to really address it. So that's what people are talking about. And that's why it's such a big deal. And what's funny, as with everything, I'm sure you've seen this too, Carlos, in the financial markets, when something like this happens, the people who are always bearish come in and say, see, we told you so, you know, batten down the hatches, the world's about to end. And the people who are always bullish come in and say, ah, yield, this is a great time to buy stocks. Historically, look at blah, blah, blah. You know, so it's like everyone always uses history to, quote, prove exactly opposite recommendations. And so, you know, the average person, the average investor is left flat-footed and flummoxed because it looks like everybody's lying. So again, that's what I'm getting at here is you can see how if a recession were coming, that would knock down stocks. And so if you pick your time right, you might say, oh, well, see, a yield curve inversion signals a great time to jump in and buy stocks. Right. Whereas, you know, depending on, you could say, oh, that's also a good time to get out of stocks right before the market crashes. So it depends what your time frame is. You can use statistics to prove anything you want. But clearly, if a bad recession is coming, then that should give you some idea of what you think the stock market's going to do. Let me just mention from an Austrian point of view. So this is not just, you know, mere following charts and, you know, having no theory behind it. It actually makes sense. So I'll be real brief about this, Carlos, because I want to focus on the stuff you have to talk about for this episode. But from an Austrian point of view, folks, remember the business cycle in terms of, you know, Mises and Hayek and what they talked about, it has to do with pushing down interest rates because the banking system, both the commercial banks and the central bank, obviously, if one exists, floods the financial sector with artificial credit that pushes down interest rates to artificially low levels, that fuels an unsustainable boom. And then eventually when the banking system backs off, stops pumping in so much unbacked credit, if you will, then interest rates rise and you get the crash. So if just, you know, let's stipulate for the sake of argument that basic Austrian story is correct. And so in that context, then, what in practice would that look like if instead of just talking about the interest rate, instead we have interest rates of various maturities, right? So there is not in the real world, it's not just the interest rate. You say, well, what's the yield on, you know, first of all, just to say treasuries, is that what you mean? Or do you mean AAA bonds? Do you mean BBB bonds? You know, so there's all kinds of different interest rates. And so let's say we're talking about treasuries. Okay. Even there, again, there's not the yield on treasuries. It depends. Do you mean a 1 month, a 2 month, a 3 month, the 10 year, 30 year? And so when we say that the financial sector gets flooded with unbacked credit, you know, not backed by genuine saving, but just because, like, let's say the Fed creates money out of thin air through some QE program, what that's going to do, yes, it'll push down interest rates in the short run at least, but it won't push down rates of all maturities equally. It'll tend to push down short-term rates more. And the reason for that, and this isn't like an Austrian point, like every economist would agree with what I just said, that the central bank has more ability to control shorter term rates than longer term ones. And the reason is pretty simple. If the Fed's going to create $50 billion and go buy a bunch of bonds, yes, that can raise the market price of bonds, which pushes down their yield. That's the way that the Fed, quote, pushes down interest rates. But if it goes and buys, you know, 3 month treasuries, that'll have one type of effect. But if the fact that the Fed's created $50 billion more dollars will tend to push up price inflation, okay? And that takes time to work through the system. And so if you think about it, if the Fed creates $50 billion and goes and buys a bunch of one-month treasuries, yes, that will push up the market price of those treasuries. That'll push down their yield. But then the other effect will be now there's $50 billion more dollars in the system that will tend to push up prices in general, especially as that money gets spent by the various recipients and works its way around. So if it raises price inflation over the next 10 years, you know, that will make investors require a higher yield on 10-year treasuries than they otherwise would have before that new $50 billion got created. So if you just think about it, whereas, you know, the full effects in terms of raising prices in general and weakening the dollar might not fully manifest themselves within 30 days. So if the Fed's just buying one-month treasuries, the full effect of that inflation, the monetary inflation, is not kicking in right in that first 30 days. So that inflationary component where you're going to insist on a higher nominal interest rate just to cover the fact that the dollar's weakening more quickly, that's not going to show up as to augment the yield on a one-month treasury. Whereas the Fed's creating billions and billions of dollars, these, you know, massive bond buying programs, that might actually make 30-year yields, nominal yields, go up, right? If the Fed does a bunch of monetary inflation, so people think, wow, before I thought average price inflation, CPI, was going to rise by about 2% a year. But now because the Fed's creating all this money over the next 30 years, I think average price inflation, CPI inflation, is going to be more like 3.5%. Well, then that would make interest rates, you know, long-term interest rates, at least 1.5 percentage points higher just to cover for that extra price inflation, right? So I'm belaboring the point here, but to try to get to click with you. So again, this isn't a narrow Austrian observation. In general, economists would tend to agree to the extent that central banks have any control over interest rates, over nominal interest rates, they can push down short rates perhaps, but if they really print up a bunch of money or create it electronically, they might not be able to suppress long-term rates because the inflationary element offsets the fact that they're absorbing that debt themselves. Okay, so don't worry, folks. We the light's at the end of the tunnel here. We're almost done with this chain of reasoning. Now just put those two things together. Put the Austrian view of the business cycle together with what I just said, and now it makes perfect sense. So during a boom period, right, the banking system creates a bunch of artificial liquidity that tends to push down interest rates. But which interest rates? The short-term rates in particular. And if anything, it might even push up long-term rates because now people expect more price inflation. So that gives you a, quote, normal yield curve where short rates are low, long rates are high. You go through several years of the boom phase and now, inflation's getting out of hand. You know, the standard measures price inflation. The central bank gets nervous. What do? Asset bubbles are blowing up. What do? Slam on the brakes, you know, suck liquidity out or at least stop the massive inflow of liquidity to reduce it. So now we would just normally say, oh, interest rates rise because the Fed tightened. But which interest rates? Again, it's the opposite. That when the Fed tightens, it has more ability to spike relatively short-term interest rates, whereas long-term rates, if they might even go down when the Fed tightens, because again, now with the tightening, people expect lower price inflation over the next 30 years. And so they need less of a component in the nominal return on a 30-year treasury just to cover for that price inflation. So again, paradoxically, when the central bank tightens, long rates, again, depending on the scenario, conceivably could even go down. But for sure, in the normal situation, they go down, but even if they go up by less in terms of percentage point movements than short-term rates do. So what does that mean? You're in a normal environment with the boom, with the, you know, the yield curve upward sloping, the Fed tightens, that's going to send short rates shooting up and long rates might even go down a little bit. And so that's what gives you the inversion. So it's not that the inversion per se has magical powers that, quote, causes a recession. No, the way I think of it is it's the normal Austrian business cycle theory story. But when you bring in the extra nuance of the fact that there's multiple maturities and the Fed actually has a better ability to control short rates versus long rates, it pops right out of that, oh, yeah, during an inflationary boom, you would see an upward sloping yield curve. And then during a tightening phase after a boom period, you would see a flattening of the yield curve or possibly even an inversion. And it's not surprising that right after a boom and then a tightening, there's a crash. And so it's not that the yield curve causes the crash. It's that the same monetary and credit policies both cause the boom bust and also cause an upward sloping and then a flattening or inverted yield curve. And so we tend to see those two things hand in hand, even though, you know, there's a more fundamental cause underlying it. Okay, so that's those are my thoughts on the yield curve and what we've seen. So again, the breaking news was the certain measures of the yield curve have inverted. And now people are just watching to see, is this going to, you know, is this going to last, or is it going to go back to quote normal? And are other measures also going to be brought in? So there's a lot of literature there giving the empirical correlation. This ties right in with the big picture view that Carlson and I have been talking about, saying, yep, these QE programs, Fed's going to blow up bubbles, but it's artificial. It's built on quicksand, and people need to be aware of that. Any thoughts on that stuff, Carlos, before we switch gears?
Well, you know, obviously, a lot of this can get very, very complicated for a lot of folks. And underneath it all is the R word, you know, recession. And I think most people understand that a recession, especially business owners, will realize that we have a recession start to set in. It makes all kinds of things just back up. It clogs up the pipes big time. And we're already seeing a lot of indicators of a slowdown of the economy. And so, you know, yes, you can see that the Fed would naturally want to continue to goose the stock market in order to keep that sort of wealth effect going as much as possible. The stock market's a very emotional market. Most people, even though they may not understand a lot of what you have just said, they get a sense that if the stock market is rising, that it's an indicator that all things are well. But when you have mainstream news now, even predicting, you know, and talking about the inversion of the curve, and also speaking recession quite boldly now, I mean, all of a sudden it's a different story. So that's my analysis of all of that. And again, for business owners, it's something to tune into, definitely.
Yeah, exactly. And I should clarify, it's obviously, I mean, the business owners know this, but for the other people listening, it's not merely that, oh, because why? Business owners tend to be invested in the stock market. No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying the business owner, as Carlos is saying, cares about recessions, because especially depending on what kind of sector you're in or industry, your sales might fall off a cliff if there's a recession.
Exactly. So, exactly.
Okay, so there's the Austrian component, and now we move into the segment where Carlos talks about practical implementation of IBC. And so here, Carlos, this was my suggestion, folks. We get this question a lot, and Carlos, you know, has thought about it in his own, you know, as he consults with business owners over the last 30, 40 years here. So he has some thoughts. And so the question is, okay, yeah, I've been, you know, so here I'm pretending to be the hypothetical member of the general public who reads this, you know, reads Becoming Your Own Banker, reads the case for IBC, what have you, says, oh yeah, this is great. I totally see how, as a business owner, I want to get one or more of these quote IBC policies. This is fantastic stuff. But hey, I thought of a good idea that I haven't seen you guys spell out in your books. If I have the business be the entity that actually owns the life insurance policy, well, then the premiums I pay, you know, as the business, those are business expenses. And so, you know, that's tax deductible, as it were, right? Because my business is only getting taxed on the net income that it accrues, or, you know, if it transfers, you know, passes it through to me as the individual. Clearly, if the business expense is a certain level, then that, you know, reduces the income that flows through to me as the owner or as the employee, what have you. However, I do it to myself, pay it to myself. Either way, if that premium payment, instead of me just eating that as an individual, if I can have the business be responsible for that because the business is the owner of the policy, well, then it seems like that's a huge tax advantage. And so, wow, this is great. I can get all the benefits of IBC that the average person gets, but I also get to write off effectively my premium payments as a business expense. So I'm even more ahead of the game. This is amazing. So that it's an understandable impulse, Carlos. And that's clearly, you know, that's where my mind went too when I first was getting into this stuff. But actually, you think, generally speaking, a business owner wants to personally be the owner of the policy. So why don't you take over from here and just explain to people why, actually, even though there's that one little pro that I mentioned, there's a lot of cons too.
Right, right. And, you know, you alluded to the situation very well, in that it's a natural thing to think that that's what you ought to do. is have the business own the policy so that you can, you know, expense out the premium payments. This question comes up repeatedly, Bob, and you know this. And it's as I've thought about it, is that when an individual begins to see and understand the IBC concept, you have to think in terms of, you know, how much of the concept that they truly understand. If they really understood the concept, they would automatically know by having read Becoming Your Own Banker and all the things we've always talked about is that you never want to lose sight of the fact that you should be the banker. You, the individual, should be the banker. And this is one of the things that Nelson's always harped on, the fact that people lose sight of who the players are. So in order to get yourself back to thinking correctly about IBC, you ask, who's the banker here? IBC is you being the banker in all cases, you the individual. Now, the one primary reason why you the individual want to own the policy is simply because in that sense, you have almost complete privacy to that cash flow system. Anything else is going to involve you in a lot of reporting, you know, to the government and other forms you have to fill out. So that's one quick way of me saying always own the policy individually, even for business owners. Now, it can get complicated simply because, as we were talking about in our very last podcast before this one, Bob, we were talking about all of the different taxing entities that business owners, you know, get into. There's various taxing entities out there that you, as a business owner, you can choose to be in. And you get with an attorney, you get with a CPA when you're forming your corporation, and you go through with those financial professionals why you're choosing to be in such and such taxing entity as opposed to another one. So let me just give you an example of why it's important to not only own the policy individually, but also get the most tax benefits from owning it individually. And not having the business own the policy. I myself am a C corporation. Now, a C corporation is a taxing entity that is different from me. Even though I incorporated that taxing entity, I mean, it is a different entity. The IRS sees it as a completely different entity. So in my particular case, I truly am an employee of my corporation. Now, the bad thing about a C corporation is that I will get taxed twice at the end of the year. I will get taxed corporately, and then I'm going to turn around and get taxed individually. So in a C corp, the bad thing about a C corp is that you have double taxation. So I have a natural motivation to make sure that I empty out, you know, the cash out of my corporation before I get to the end of the year. And I work very closely with my CPA to make sure that I accomplish that goal. He's very helpful to me because he understands exactly what I'm trying to do so that I don't pay tax twice. Now, there are other taxing entities out there that business owners use, which are what they call flow-through corporations. Now, some of these other entities would be like a partnership. A partnership is a taxing entity, but it's a flow-through corporation. Another one would be the LLC. That's also a flow-through corporation. And then you have what is known as a PLLC, which is an LLC, but it's mostly for professionals like attorneys and CPAs. They have a PLLC. It's a newer form of taxing entity that came out in the late 90s. And then, of course, all of these taxing entities have what we call the corporate shield, which protects the individual from creditors. All right, so that's very important to have. Mm-hmm. So all of those corporations have that shield, except for one particular taxing entity, which is the sole proprietorship. Now, that's a flow-through corporation, but it has no shield. And as when we were discussing our last episode, how many corporations or how many taxing entities are out there that are sole proprietorship, it's a huge amount. So we have a lot of business owners that are very, heavily exposed to creditors. But it usually tend to be very, very small businesses that choose the sole proprietorship. Now, the other corporation that's out there, it's a flow-through corporation, is the S corporation. And that's what you said you were.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so as you know, whatever you make out of that corporation, it flows straight to you. But you also have profit at the end of the year, the same way. And so you have expenses, and you want to try to expense things out. So I wanted to walk through all those different taxing entities and why, they vary. But when it comes to IBC, what you want to do, obviously, in order to own it individually, is you want to pull out enough of an income to be able to fund the IBC policy. That's really what you're trying to do. And you wind up doing that through a W-2 bonus, a bonus at the end of the year. You pull out as much as you can out of the corporation, and then you use that to fund your IBC policy individually. Now, that should be the goal. Now, what makes it difficult for the business owner is this. The business owner must understand what the concept of IBC very, very clearly and why he's using it. Obviously, it's a cash flow system or a financing system. It's going to provide the business owner working capital. These are very important concepts to the business owner. Once he sees what IBC is really all about, his job now is going to be to have to sell his CPA on the concept and maybe even his attorney. He first must understand it very well and why he wants to own that policy individually, and he's going to have to use the aid and assistance of his CPA in order to make it possible for him to do it, and stay within the proper taxing guidelines. And so I always say to business owners, you'll want your professionals, especially your CPA and maybe even your tax attorney, those people that work very closely with you on your business to also understand what IBC is. Otherwise, it's going to be very, very difficult, to get them to agree to doing this. So that's one very important thing that I would say to business owners. Make sure you understand the IBC concept. Clearly, if you do, you'll see very clearly why you should be owning the policy individually and not owning it, through the business. It's not about just deducting those premium payments. It's making sure that it remains very private, and that's really what you want. Now, if you have a large business where you've got a lot of employees and maybe some of those employees are either partners or they're shareholders in your business, then the business owner now has another job he's got to do if he wants to incorporate IBC. He's going to have to sell his inner circle of employees that may be shareholders or maybe partners on the concept of IBC as well, so that they can cooperate with him in being able to make the IBC move. So I think that's very important. What I'm finding is that either business owners and even financial professionals that don't clearly understand what the IBC concept is, one of the first things they go to is what you said to, Bod. You say, well, you know what? This is a great idea. Why don't I just have the business own it, and that way I can expense out the premiums? It's a natural move to go there. But I am trying to tell everybody on this podcast that's not what you do with IBC. The primary reason that you would even want the business to own the policy, and keeping in mind you're exchanging privacy and you're exchanging a lot of complications. You're bringing on a lot of complications to yourself and your company when you try to do it that way. But a lot of businesses do it, but the primary reason for doing it is mostly for executive and or succession planning for businesses. And the end result of that is really the death benefit. So that's not what IBC is about. But if you start out thinking that what I need is succession planning or executive planning, you know, and where the death benefit is going to be the key thing, well, sure, then you may want the business to own the policy.
Can I stop you for a second, Carlos?
Sure.
Make sure people, I know we, you know, some listeners are going to know exactly what you're talking about, but other ones might be unfamiliar with these distinctions you're making. So let me paraphrase to make sure I'm tracking what you're saying, that you're saying, it's common in the business world. Like if there's a, you know, two partners who have a partnership together, and it's like, wow, it would be if Joe died, you know, that would really hurt the business. And so you might want to have a life insurance policy on Joe. And, you know, the point would be because he's a very valuable asset to the company. Just like if you had an expensive piece of equipment that was crucial to your business, you'd want to have that thing insured because in case it got wrecked in a, you know, fire or something, that, you know, you'd need to be able to replace that so the business wouldn't suffer. And so you're just taking insurance. So likewise, if you got key individuals, you know, key man insurance kind of thing, you know, that's standard for companies to have insurance policies on their executives or, you know, the owners, if there's multiple ones for that reason. But there you're saying that the point is not to use the insurance policy as a cash flow management vehicle. It's just standard. Well, yeah, if this particular asset, which happens to be a human being, disappears, the business suffers. And so we just want to have insurance on that for its value. And, you know, and so forth. And so that's what the death benefit does. So you're saying, you know, that's normal and people have been doing that for a long time. But you're saying if the reason you want to get one of these IBC policies is because of what Nelson Nash is talking about, then that's an entirely different animal and you shouldn't be thinking of it in those other terms. And, you know, if you as the individual want to become your own banker, you know, the title of the book is not have your business own something that can mimic banking functions. It's become your own banker. And so you're saying you're actually not your own banker. If the company owns it, you lose a lot of the benefits. Is that okay what I said?
That's exactly it. Yes. Having the business own insurance policies is very, very common. And, you know, large businesses, small businesses, they do this. They will do this, but it's for different reasons, Bob, like you said. IBC is a cash flow, a financing system. It's cash flow is what we're talking about. It's working capital for the business. So it has nothing to do with succession planning or, you know, creating some sort of employee benefit plans. But that's when you would want the business to own the policy. Now, even in some of these situations where you have the employer own the policy, you get into having to report to the IRS on a annual basis, you know, that you've got some sort of a benefit plan that's been designed for your employees, and that's why you have the ownership there. Or you've got a succession plan, as you said, Bob, with some key employees, you know, key man insurance, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, those kinds of things, it's very common to do, but that's not IBC. You know, on a very simple way to think about it is to say, if you're going to let the business own the policy, then the business is going to receive the death benefit.
Mm-hmm.
You'll probably be the insured because you're the incorporator and the owner. You'll be the insured. You die, the business gets the tax free benefit, income free to the business, and now you got to figure out how you're going to take that money out of the business without paying taxes on it.
let me stop you right there, because that's a critical point when you first point. So again, folks, what Carlos is saying there is one of the reasons IBC is so great when owned by the individual is that when the insured party dies, and remember, it doesn't have to be you yourself. The owner of the policy can be a different person from the insured party. So when that death does occur, the death benefit typically is paid income tax free to the named beneficiary or plural beneficiaries. And so Carlos's point is if the business is the owner of the policy and is the recipient of that death benefit, then now your business has these proceeds. And if you're, let's say it was somebody else that you were insuring, you know, like you're, you know, whatever, a partner or something, if the business is the owner and gets that, then now, okay, the business has it, great. But if you want to bonus yourself that money or do a dividend or whatever, depending on, you know, what your structure is, that's still now standard income from the business going to you, either as the owner or as an employee or whatever. And so now the tax issue comes in. So, it doesn't matter how did the business acquire that money. It matters how are you passing it to yourself. So that's another, again, so it's not that there's like a huge flaw in a business owning a life insurance policy and it's done all the time. But the point is you're neutering some of the advantages of IBC if you do it that way.
That's exactly correct, Bob. And this is not to discourage business owners that may have already gone that route or plan on doing something like that. If what they're thinking about is succession planning, that's the key, or creating some sort of a benefit plan for their employees. Those are all things that are done all the time. And they're good. I'm not saying they're bad. But that's not IBC is the main point to realize. That's not IBC. Now, let me tell you, where this whole why I keep saying, if you go down the track of the business being the owner, you're getting into a lot of regulation and a lot of reporting. A lot of it came about after 2006, actually. Where it all stems from, Bob, is I know that several years ago I wrote an LMR article entitled "That Bank Owned Life Insurance Was on the Rise." Mm-hmm.
Or BOLI, B-O-L-I.
Yeah, BOLI, that's right. Now, that is a very clear example of an employer owning, life insurance policies on their employees for the death benefit, to receive those proceeds from the death benefit. And not only were banks doing this, but also businesses were doing this. It's called EOLI, employer-owned life insurance, okay? And prior to 2006, what was happening was that these employers and or banks, were just taking out life insurance policies on rank-and-file employees. That's why they refer to it as janitor insurance. Mm-hmm. And of course, those employees would quit, leave the company or whatever, and if they died, all the proceeds of that death benefit went to the employer. And of course, there was once the general public caught on to what was happening there, I mean, they started suing, but of course they didn't win. However, Congress did set up new rules for that type of ownership of policies on individual employees, okay? And so the rules that they established after 2006, now, by the way, anything that was done by either banks or employees prior to 2006, I mean, it's still in place. I think in that article I wrote that commercial banks have something like $40 billion in death benefit coming to them still.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but after 206, you know, Congress set up some very specific rules about the employer, you know, owning life insurance policies on their employees. And so those rules are in place. And, you know, they're just that those rules take away the privacy that you have in owning the policy individually. And that's what we keep stressing here, is that it's natural to think that it's better for the business to own the policy because you're thinking you're getting a benefit by being able to deduct the expense, but you're trading it off for privacy that you're going to lose, and also, just all kinds of reporting to the IRS and forms you got to fill out and that kind of stuff. And I you need to see that distinction.
And also, besides the privacy element and the control, because also too, folks, it gets messy. I've heard you bring it up elsewhere, Carlos, when we were talking about this years ago, that if you have, you know, if it's a partnership or if you're just a shareholder in a corporation and the business owns it, well, then now, you know, you don't have unilateral control over that asset. You know, there are other owners of the company, either partners or shareholders, if it's a corporation, where, you know, technically you might get outvoted as to, you know, how to use this.
Well, yeah, that's true. But once again, you'll even have that kind of a problem if you've got a business that has, a group of shareholders in your company and or partners in your company. And I'm stressing, the business owner that understands the concept has got a dual job now. He's going to have to sell his CPA on IBC and why he wants it. And he's also going to have to sell either his shareholders and or partners on the concept of IBC and why they should have that, you see. So make sure that you understand what IBC is, you know, and not think of it, you know, as, well, quite frankly, life insurance, the death benefit. As you know, that IBC is more concentrated on the cash value of the policy. The death benefit is there, yes, but the concentration is on the cash value simply because we're using it as the cash flow system. That's the main thing to keep in mind.
Mm-hmm. The point about the death benefit flowing income tax-free, that's another huge component. So let me just give the standard caveats here, folks. Okay, Carlos and I are not giving you tax advice. We're not giving you financial advice. Obviously, you run this by the relevant professionals before you do anything. But we are just trying to give you the big picture here to see the kind of considerations you want to keep in mind. Also, again, don't misunderstand. This is a life insurance policy, right? So, yes, it will have to be underwritten, and the underwriters, they don't care what you're using. You know, they're going to say what's the human life value of the person that's being insured. You know, I mean, so that's what the number's going to, where it's going to come from in terms of the how much they can underwrite it for. So it is a life insurance policy. There's nothing magic about it. But our point is, if you understand Nelson's philosophy, he's showing you, look at some of these features of a regular dividend paying whole life insurance policy in terms of policy loans. Look at what you can do with this thing, that even though, yes, it's, quote, just a life insurance policy, look at this, you know, this very convenient policy loan feature that they come with. If you properly design it, look at what you can do with this thing even while you're still alive. And so Carlos's point is, if that's what's making you interested in this and you want a life insurance policy properly designed to, you know, maximize its usefulness from the point of view of someone like Nelson Nash, he's just pointing out that you're kind of doing it with one hand tied behind your back if the business owns it. And that's what we've spent the last 20 minutes trying to get you to see. Okay, but don't misunderstand. It is a life insurance policy. But the point is, you can really fulfill the vision that Nelson Nash had and what you can do with these things far better if you yourself own it. Last thing we'll say, I know we're over time here, Carlos, but just in case people are confused. So you can still, you know, your business can still benefit from you incorporating IBC into your life. And it's real simple. So let's, you know, say you're a dentist and your business right now is borrowing money from outside people because you have expensive equipment that you use in your practice, and then, you know, you're waiting for customer payments to come in, and that's how you pay down the outside creditors. And at the same time, you're socking money away in, you know, your IRA or something in terms of your, quote, retirement planning. And you're reading Nelson's book and you realize, oh, wait a minute, I'm doing this all wrong. I should become my own banker, blah, blah, blah. You still do it, but very quickly, the basic structure is not that the business now goes and buys a policy. You, the individual, get up an IBC policy, and then your business, instead of borrowing money from outside creditors in order to buy your new fancy equipment, instead, your business borrows money from you, the individual. You personally make a loan to your business, and you do it officially. Like, you have a document and everything, and there's an interest rate that you're charging. And so now your business can still deduct the interest payments on that loan, but just make sure you dot all your I's and cross all your T's. Then you, the individual, now have to report in your own personal filings the interest income received on that. Okay, so the two things have to correspond to each other. If your business is deducting an outgoing interest payment, you, the individual receiving that payment, have to declare that as interest income. So they all mesh, correctly. But that's how your business can still wean itself off of reliance on outside lenders, while we're still respecting the wisdom Carlos has in this episode, saying generally speaking, again, we're not saying it's impossible to come up with a scenario, but we're saying generally speaking, the individual wants to be the one owning the life insurance policy that's designed, to be an IBC type policy. And then the way, again, your business borrows from you, the individual.
Yeah, let me make one last comment, because I don't want business owners listening to this thinking, well, this is really for small businesses, you see. Now, that's not true, you see. I mentioned that you can take the money to fund the policy individually out of a bonus that you take out, as part of your income. But you could, if you're a large company and you have, like I said, shareholders or other partners, you can take it out of retained earnings, or I guess in an LLC, they call it the capital account. If you take the money out of there, it comes out tax free. But again, this is why you need to be able to work with your CPA. You need to establish that relationship, because the CPA needs to understand very clearly why it is that you want to use this. And that CPA has got to understand what IBC is. Once he understands it, he's going to make it happen for you. That's the key.
Exactly. So, folks, why don't we wrap it up here? I know we're over time here, but I hope you see, once you start going into this stuff, there's a lot of nuances. And just hearing Carlos off the top of his head here start talking about things, you can see the wisdom and knowledge he has from his 40 so years of consulting with business owners on this stuff. And so I encourage you, if you're a business owner, to sign up for our seminar to be held in Nashville, Tennessee, on May 10th, 2019. Again, more details about what we're going to offer and the logistics are available at lauramurphy.com/bizowner. And either way, we'll catch all of you next time for part 3 of 3 of this 3-part series on IBC and the Business Owner. And we'll see you then.
You've just finished another episode of The Laura Murphy Show. Be sure to share this podcast with your friends and colleagues to do your part in building the 10%.
The Laura Murphy Show is provided with the understanding that the staff and contributors of lauramurphy.com are not here and engaged in rendering legal, accounting, tax, or investment advice. On such matters, please consult your own professional tax, legal, or financial advisor.